Today, we continue with our eight 80s events that shaped the 2000s, and we are discussing the variant cover. In fact, we are discussing the birth of the variant cover. Variant covers are everywhere. That you are collecting them. Your retailer is pulling out his hair, trying to figure out how many to order. It is the age of the variants, and you think that the variant cover became a thing in the 90s, and you would be wrong. It was born in the 80s. This craze has its roots deep in the 80s. We're going to walk you through all of the timelines and find out exactly how we ended up with variants the way that we did now. And we're doing it today on an all-new episode of Robservation. Hey, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Robservations. I am your host, Rob Liefeld, and these are my Robservations. I have been making comics for just shy of 40 years, four decades in this business that I love so much, that is my passion, that is my obsession, making, creating, writing, drawing, producing comic books, and I have been consuming them for 50 years, since I was 7 years old, pulling them off of these incredible spinner racks. Robservations exists to celebrate the world of comic books, the world of superheroes, the amazing creators and the movers and shakers behind the scenes that have created and contributed to the modern comic book industry. Today, we are continuing our series, eight 80s events that shaped the 2000s, and we are going to look at the birth, the modern day birth of the variant comic book. Yes, the variant comic book. I said it twice so it would sink in. The modern day variant comic book is attributed to moves and initiatives that were created in the 80s. I wish so much that when we talk about the 80s, 80s music would come on and it would blare and it would be Cyndi Lauper, Girls Just Want to Have Fun, even though I absolutely hated that song. But it just really signifies a time. Bruce Springsteen, Dancing in the Dark, Madonna, Prince, Michael Jackson, because the 80s is more defined by music to me than any other era. And I prefer, my favorite 80, gun to my head, anybody who knows me knows that the 70s is my preferred era. The yacht rock of the 70s is my go-to old man music. But I was a teenager in the 80s, and it was exciting. MTV, watching the birth of MTV, watching these incredible music icons, watching the music define the era, and they became these big, giant, larger-than-life figures, as big as movie stars, these musicians did. And so I was reading and consuming comic books while this music blared through the cars and on the overhead speakers, wandering through the mall, the malls of our youth in the 80s. Many of you had comic book stores in your malls. I didn't encounter a comic book store in a mall until I went to Chicago and lived there in the summer of 1985 after graduating high school. And I was helping out with my family and my dad and some of his medical complications. And in the malls of the boroughs of Illinois, Chicago, I was like, wow, there's a comic book store in here. In Southern California, where I was collecting, they were all part standalone comic book stores, part of just different retail allotments on major streets or in retail centers. Nothing was in a mall. But again, the music and the comic books of the 80s are very, very memorable and are very significant to me. But it is during this crazy time, our first installment of eight 80s events that define the 2000s talked about derivatives and how, truthfully, you do not get to either the Spider-Verse or the Deadpool core without so many of the intensifying of the derivatives that happened. Most everything that we discuss, even including today with the variant covers, they will have maybe a kernel of growth prior to the 80s, something that maybe happened in the 60s, the 70s, but it was like you can have a derivative family of Captain Marvel's as DC's Shazam slash Captain Marvel icon was in regards to the Marvel family. It was not just Captain Marvel. It was Captain Marvel Jr. It was Mary Marvel. They expanded the identification. Captain Marvel Jr. had a blue costume with a yellow lightning bolt as opposed to Captain Marvel's red costume with a lightning bolt. And I liked Captain Marvel Jr. I liked it. I liked the blue and the yellow more. And again, sometimes we just differentiate through color. But in the 80s, it was like game on. Let's start making many more duplicates, but really duplicates isn't a cool word. Derivatives is. So we discussed derivatives in part one of the eight 80s events that define the 2000s. But today it is all about the modern day variant and how it absolutely sprung out of some very definitive moves. And really by one company in particular, the modern variant obsession was born in the 80s. But before we get to the seminal events of the 80s that brought us the modern variant covers, we're going to work backwards. We're going to work backwards from today, from today's marketplace. And you all know the variant scene has gotten completely just shy of out of hand. And like, Liefeld, you do variant covers. I do. 1,000% confirmed, confessed. I participate in variant covers, and I produce variant covers for my own books. And truthfully, it can be very satisfying if variant covers is something that you want to participate in. The entirety of the variant cover market is something that is much more overwhelming for your retailer. When I am doing variant covers for, like, say, my own comic, a book that I am putting out exclusively on my live streams over at the Whatnot app, I maintain those. They're very small print runs. Every 100 copies, we initiate a different cover to really keep it contained. But that's just my particular comic. And let's say at this point, we have eight versions of that cover. Well, I know that there are comic books that are being solicited in the catalogs right now that have upwards to 15 covers for a single launch issue. I know that there are comics in the last couple of years. For instance, I know at the absolute apex practice of this was the back-to-back months of, I believe, August of 2019 and September of 2019, when Marvel with House of X and then with Maximum Carnage. It was one of the Carnage or the Venom events that were happening with the symbiote books. The special launch books had between 24 and 25 variant covers, and that's not counting retail incentives when the retailer participates. That's just what the publisher is offering you. The A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L. I mean, it gets to be a lot, right? Now, my retailer, my local retailers have told me that for the most part, they have stopped ordering anything outside of the A cover other than when they are specifically asked to carry a C, a D. And of course, then that becomes a crapshoot because you know that you may end up running to another store or another marketplace. I've mentioned several times, Frank and Sons is a dedicated comic book and collectible pop culture marketplace that is open on Wednesdays and Saturdays and Sundays regularly. And the comic dealers will tell you often they get visits from people who didn't get the cover that they wanted at their, you know, brick and mortar store that they frequent. And they run to Frank and Sons to see if any of the existing retailers may have that D or B or even the A cover because they weren't able to obtain it. So let's not kid ourselves. Variant covers are very much a part of the everyday comic book existence for retailers. And I do feel for them because I couldn't imagine having to order 100 or 200 different versions of what I'm doing on my book, Last Blood, which is something that I wrote and I drew and I illustrated and it's brand new. And I've just wanted to print them in every 100 increments and to isolate each of those increments. They have a different cover and or trade dress. And trust me, trade dress is going to come come into kind of the earliest days, the birth of the variant cover that we're going to be discussing today. Most famously, X-Men number one with Jim Lee, 1991. Five connecting covers is probably the most famous variant in modern history. It drove sales of 8 million copies. It was a cover that you and I both showed up to. I was working in the business. The comic book store was 10 minutes from our office. Murat Michaels, who was working at my assistant's, comic books came out on Fridays then, not on Wednesdays. They didn't move till Wednesdays till the middle of the 90s. The Friday release of each of those X-Men issues found me showing up to buy the latest X-Men installment, along with all the other comics that were coming out regularly. But I bought each of the five covers plus the sixth that collected all of them in one. So it really was six variants. And I bought all of them. I bought all of them. I wanted to collect them. I wanted to connect them. I caught what is called the fever. And so much of what drives variant covers is the fever. And we're gonna again go back and really start to examine when the fever first really went off. There were variants, but then there was one that lit the fever. We've discussed it here before, but again, it is important to note that the 80s is where this happened, not the 90s. The 80s. The dates don't lie, and you're gonna find out, you know, how this really caught fire. And again, once you get the fever, because the fever is when you're standing there and you're wondering, do I want that other cover? Do I want that other cover? And then you see the other guy, he's right next to you and he's about to grab for it. And then he does. And then there may be only two left. And you're like, well, shoot, if I don't get it now, I may not get it. Boom, the fever has struck. You have reached across. You have grabbed that copy from the shelf. The fever caught you. You weren't even sure that you wanted it, but now you have it. You're taking it up to the counter and you are purchasing it because the idea of you not having it was more important than the idea of actually having it and not having it. What was going to haunt you? So you pulled the trigger on that purchase, okay? And you made that variant part of your collection. So this has become so just incredibly dominant in the business, and both Marvel, DC, Image, everybody participates. There were a couple companies a couple years ago who decided, hey, we're going to be the standout, and we're going to announce we're not doing variants. Well, that. Everyone knew how that was going to play out, and it did, because the other companies went, wait, you're not going to do variants? Well, then we'll do more. Because as a retailer told me the other night, when I did their retail show, they said, Rob, there is a fever. There is a demand. There is a style, a brand of collector who wants to be buying and adding to their collection at all times. And if retailer A doesn't offer it, and I do, that they're going to buy from me. And there is some real deep collector truths in that reality. I have often stated here on the show that myself as a fan, and as a professional, because once I became a professional, I still remain a fan, but in my deepest obsession as a fan in my teens, I have told you that because comic books, We didn't see ahead. We didn't have catalogs. We couldn't anticipate what was coming. And you didn't get preview art. There weren't websites to see pages in advance. You literally got what you got when you arrived there. You saw that cover, those interiors. Really speaking of 1979, 1980, the full throes of the John Byrne X-Men run with Terry Austin and just really the most popular kind of most feverish, because people were just freaking out about each and every episode because they were beautiful. They were incredible. They had great, you know, soap opera elements and drama and consequences and big twists and turns. I would have gladly bought two copies. I was already, so let me explain to you. I was already buying two copies of every issue. X-Men 139, two copies, 137, two copies, 138, two copies, 141, probably three copies. I loved it so much. I wanted to have two that I kept in nice condition and one that I would read through, but just having more just seemed to fill my heart more. Why not have more of this? Because I love it so much. Had there been two John Byrne copies, I may have been purchasing four. Okay. I may have been purchasing four. And let me go back to the events of the 80s, because we're going to get to those in an upcoming episode called Event Horizon. Secret Wars and Crisis on Infinite Earths, the two biggest kind of most seminal, impactful, consequential crossover series, not of all time, but also, you know, mired in the relevance and the popularity of the 80s. Those launched with one cover each. Imagine if the original Secret Wars had multiple covers. Okay? Imagine if it had launched with two. It would have seemingly doubled its output given the absolute craze that Secret Wars was a part of. Ditto on Crisis. You slap two covers on that bad boy, you are going to have sold even more. So some of this is, as we look and exist right now, we go back and we think about, what if some of these giant launches, what if Frank Miller's Wolverine number one had two cover options? Because really, this is how the variant cover craze started in the 80s, is with the two cover options. And we're almost there. We're almost to the birth of this. But it's important to note that in the 70s, both Marvel and DC experimented. This is I just want to give you the full spectrum so that you can say, hey, he covered all of it. In the 70s, they were, 1975, 76, 77, during this period, they were experimenting with different blurbs on the cover. They even did a limited amount of variants in different parts of the country with different pricing to see if you'd buy a 25-cent comic for 30 cents. Just like they have test menus. You guys, my first encounter with the test menu was in 1995, visiting Friends of Joy's out in Texas. And they had the Frito burrito at Taco Bell. And I literally, I was such a Taco Bell fanatic. The Frito burrito, the chili Frito burrito, rolls right off the tongue. They eventually, briefly, years later, made it out to Southern California. But I went to get my chili Frito burrito from Taco Bell, which was being marketed as a test market item at this particular Taco Bell in Dallas. And I flipped out. Oh my gosh, we don't have this out here. We don't have this on the menu in Southern California. It was baffling to me. But comic books were doing the same kind of test marketing. Hey, maybe let's put in these few regions, let's make these issues of Avengers, Fantastic Four, Spider-Man, let's make them 30 cents instead of 25 cents, see if people will buy them. And if there's less resistance, then let's go through the entire line. And of course they did. The comic books did tick up very very quickly, especially from the 25 to the 30 cents. It then went to 35 to 40, 45. I've covered it with you guys that every nickel, it seemed like it was happening every year, every 16 months, the prices were going up. But still, for me, my $5 allowance for mowing all the lawns, the front and the backyard and doing all the gardening was enough to get me just a giant assortment of comic books. So, you know, as long as I could keep managing that particular budget so that I could get all my favorites, that's all that mattered to me. And it's still, I mean, yeah, when it got to 45 cents, you're like, wow, now I'm at two for a dollar. I mean, again, getting into comic books when they were 20 cents and you're like five for a buck. I mean, I am living life here. This is great. But the first test marketing of variant trade dress was with pricing and with a diamond on the box. They did some slight trade dress tweaks. But then we would get to the actual one of the trade dress tweaks for DC was that Whitman Comics, Whitman, which had done a bunch of Gold Key publishing, they were a very known brand, especially in collecting comics in the plastic bags that I have told you, and so many of you have told me, they were in airports, they were in big department stores. This is how comic books made their way into more bougie, especially given the 70s, more bougie points of purchase, where you would see them in the mall. What was in JCPenney, May Company. For me out here, there was a department store called Gemco. There was one called The Treasury. They were the earliest versions of what is now the big box store. The actual Gemcos that were up in the 70s are now Targets or Walmarts. Those giant buildings went to just further the next big box store. And the bags of comics would would different assortments, and in this case, DC Comics, would have the Whitman label, not just on the bag that you bought them on, but you were buying a Whitman comic book because along with the DC logo on the trade dress was a Whitman logo as well. So that is technically, again, what I'm talking about when I'm discussing with you the trade variants. Now, you'll find these online for sale occasionally, but they don't really differentiate with price, these trade dress variants. They don't differentiate with price much. And sometimes you'll read a report about, you know, these don't really stand out. I have some bags of Whitman comic books that are unopened that I've kept that I dig just because it really signifies a certain time and place. And that certain time and place is basically like 1977, 1978, 1979 in my mind. And it was some Marvel comics, some DC comics. And again, those bags are still really probably the most nostalgic things that I can pull out and look at, because it just really speaks to a certain time in my life and perhaps your youth as well. But that's not where variants would stop. That's just where they were scratching the surface with the different trade dresses. What really brought about the modern variant cover is what occurred in 1986. All of the previous trade dress variants, whether it was prices or a diamond in the corner to differentiate that it was coming from a different newsstand distributor or again the Whitman packaging of the books, all of that stuff was meant to identify as a different distribution network. It wasn't created with the intention of selling you more comics as this birth of this modern variant would be. The modern variant that we know it exists to get you specifically to buy more of that comic, get retailers to buy more of that comic. And in 1986, DC Comics very boldly proclaimed that they were going to restart Superman. They were going to reimagine the mythos with the biggest name in comic books, John Byrne. You wonder why I say his name all the time. It's because the man was at the center of all of the popular stuff, all of the stuff that people were just clamoring for was coming from the desk of John Byrne. He was very much the commercial wunderkind of his age and very inspirational to everybody in my peer group. Superman relaunching was a big deal. They were going to start it out with a miniseries, a six-part miniseries called The Man of Steel. And these launch issues, the number one issue of Man of Steel was going to have two covers. One, a newsstand edition, and then the other was the direct market edition, which lined up with the design element that would be on 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, which is a figure that John Byrne drew. And then to the left of that figure was a scene from the book. And so from 1, 2, and 3, you'd get Superman, Batman, Lois Lane, Lex Luthor again, and then kind of a scene depicting what was going on. It was a specific design element. But the newsstand book had a close-up of Superman, Clark Kent's chest as he is pulling away his tie and opening his shirt and exposing the famous iconic Superman logo. This was intended to be the newsstand version, this Superman chest logo variant. But of course, the direct market could order it and feature it as well. And what do you think? Do you think there was one store that didn't? They all carried them. I had about five different comic book stores, from Fullerton to Fountain Valley, Land of Oz and Oz, Adventureland, Comic Castle, Fantasy Illustrated. These were the key comic book stores. Comics Unlimited were the chains in my kind of Orange County area that I would frequent. And I'm going to tell you, each and every one of them carried both of these. The release of this was a giant, it was the first kind of blockbuster movie release. It was a big, big deal. Bigger than Secret Wars or Crisis on Infinite Earths, because it got the first time of, and we've covered how the death of Superman in our 9 controversies, in our series, the 9 controversies that shook the 90s. We talked about how the death of Superman got a ton of mainstream media. Well, that started with this launch of Superman, which got the creator who was bringing this to you, John Byrne, on the Today Show. It got mass market, mass media, New York Times, LA Times. It was covered in all of the mainstream media, this relaunch, this bold relaunch of Superman. So everybody wanted to have both of these on hand. And I know that I bought both of them. And this was like, wow, we're getting two covers on two different number ones. So this is 2 years after Secret Wars launches and about 16, 17 months after Crisis on Infinite Earths launched. Again, it's not that inconceivable to go back a couple years and think of what would Secret Wars have sold. It was already breaking records and the best-selling book that Marvel had done to date. What would that have sold if that had two or even three covers or Crisis on Infinite Earths? Well, with Man of Steel, they did offer the first variant intended with the intention to sell more copies. And so again, it wasn't just a book that you found on the newsstand. Now the direct market ones were not on the newsstand, but at the 7-Elevens and the remaining markets that had spinner racks and shelves that would sell you comic books, the newsstand edition was quite prominent. You didn't see the direct market edition in the 7-Elevens and again the grocery stores and the basic newsstand distribution markets. But you sure as heck saw the newsstand one alongside the direct market one in the comic book stores, and both sold extremely briskly. Because again, why have one when without the other you don't have a complete set? And that's our collector's mindset. It's our illness. I've told you sometimes that my love of comics I view as a partial disease, and part of that is this: I gotta have it because I just can't not have it. Now, the second, and here's the sneakiest of the bunch, the one that really snuck in there and really shocked me. After Man of Steel, another year would pass, and then we would get another kind of, I'm going to call it a chase variant. This is the first time that I felt like the comic book industry was directly indulging in what was mostly the practice of sports cards, trading cards. Was a chase variant. I was working at what would become Tustin Tunes and Toys, which is still open today on Tustin in Orange County. It is a fantastic store. Everyone there is great. You should pop in. You should say hi. You should grab their graphic novels, their comic books. Great people all around. Mike, hello. Everybody there, hello. Tustin Tunes and Toys, that location was moved. But from the location down the street, because I was still on Tustin when we opened the store in 86. And it was an extension of a chain of comic book stores called Comic Castle. And the flagship Comic Castle that I had been buying most of my comic books, like from 1981 to 1985, I was buying most of them from Comic Castle, a rival store, Adventureland, opened down the street in Fullerton, and I started going between both of them, given different availability of comic book back issues and the different stock. If one's sold out, you know, you were likely to go get it from another, and both stores were really well run. Comic Castle, the owner, Rick, was a little more ruthless, a little more competitive, and he opened this new Comic Castle location in Tustin, California, which would then sell and change hands and become Tustin Tunes and Toys. I was there for the launch of this location in Tustin, and it was during this time that this, what I call the Chase variant, arrived, and it was issue 3 of a very popular book DC, we are really leaning into, you know, man. Who was really participating and lighting the fire under the variants? DC Comics, because they're about to do it again. The third issue of Justice League. Justice League had relaunched, coming outside of another event that DC had done called Legends, and it was the Keith Giffen, Kevin Maguire, JMD Matisse, very popular, much more humor based, where Guy Gardner suddenly got a giant portion of the spotlight, and there was a lot more in jokes. But the big appeal, because again, this is comic books, was this artist that I had never seen before, but I thought he was fantastic, amazing. Especially the first year of Kevin Maguire on Justice League was like next level. Without Kevin Maguire, we don't have a bridge, a natural extension into somebody like an Adam Hughes. And Adam Hughes will tell you, because he followed Kevin on Justice League, and he will tell you exactly how influential, you know, him, the faces, the expressions, the kind of the most identifiable traits of Kevin Maguire's work, which were these incredible facial expressions and emotions that he was communicating that no one else was. It was an incredible, just a new attention to detail and facial quirks, and stopping the camera and following maybe through a smirk or a shock of the face. But Kevin's style was tight. It was clean. It was super commercial. It was very accomplished, and he came out of nowhere, and he was just as much, if not the primary reason, people my age, and I've talked to people who, again, at that time, Justice League by DC was like, wow, this is killer. This new launch of this series was incredible. Kevin Maguire on Justice League was red hot, and the book was selling out. Justice League, the first two issues, again, which was just a completely different approach. It almost felt like this cinema verite take, like you were there alongside of them as they aired kind of their grievances with each other and their doubts. And it was just a totally different, again, kudos to Keith Giffen, J.M. DeMatteis, and Kevin Maguire for giving us this incredible revolutionary take on the Justice League. Well, the third issue, the standard issue of Justice League, finds Batman and the crew, Mr. Miracle, Captain Marvel. They are backed up against the fence that looks to be protecting a Russian nuclear plant, and they are surrounded by the armored Russian warriors that seek to prevent them. So they're in this conflict at the downshot. It's really great. It's really tight. But there was a variant that two of them were in the box that I opened, because I was opening the boxes and racking the comics as part of my job working for Comic Castle in Tustin. Those two comics I was pulling out of the box, and it was as if Rick remembered right at that time, because the store phone rang. I picked up and he said, "Hey, did we get any Justice Leagues with a different cover? It's more yellow. It has Captain Marvel flying up to, you know, Batman. They're in the air." And I'm like, "Yeah, we got two of them." He goes, "Set those aside. Those are for the flagship store. Those are for the Fullerton store. Go ahead and set those aside." And I'm sitting there going, "What is this? I did not see this coming." Two variant comics, two chase variants. The rest of our box had the 30 Justice Leagues for the store, but two of these were a very specific variant drawn by Kevin Maguire. So by the artist that we were digging so much, this is exactly what I was talking about in regards to, had John Byrne drawn two issues of the X-Men, I would buy both of them. I am looking at this. It had manifested. One of my favorite new artists had drawn a separate cover to Justice League, and there was only two copies out of this alongside this other 30, and I was told to set them aside because they were going to the much bigger store, and the flagship store, the Fullerton store, was three times the size of our store. So again, he wanted those for that store to maximize at the Fullerton location. And before some of you say, "Hey, Rob, you're burying the lead with this cover," let me also explain to you that there was a trade dress differential, and it was being seen as the reason for these books to exist. On that cover, which has Captain Marvel flying up, the separate Kevin Maguire cover, which is really much more focused on just two characters, Captain Marvel and Batman, who is being wrangled in the sky by one of these Russian armored figures. And Captain Marvel says, "Hang on, Batman, I'm coming," flying up to him. The armored Russian figure is wrestling with Batman, and they are above the nuclear power plant, which is, you can see the fire and the lava is boiling over. And Captain Marvel says, "Hang on, Batman, I'm coming." And he says, "Forget me, Captain Marvel. You've got to save the world, dot, dot, dot." And then in a separate word balloon, all red letters, "From nuclear destruction." The art is great. It immediately, like me, I wanted it just for the art alone. But up in the corner, it didn't say DC Comics. Oh, there was a circular bullet, just like the DC bullet. But it was a Superman, which it appears to be either a Dick Giordano or a Jose Luis Garcia Lopez Superman illustration. Perhaps it's just out of one of their style guides. But it is a full force perspective shot of Superman flying through a bullet logo that says Superman Comics. Superman Comics, not DC Comics. So when Rick gets there, the owner of the store gets there to pick them up, because he comes back in the evening to grab these books that he had dropped them off in the afternoon. He ran his errands. He came back. He's like, "These are regional variants. These are regional variants." And he said, "I think there's something about like distributing them like below the Mason-Dixie line. Like, it's different regions. Different regions are getting it." Later, it was rumored that this was distributed to just the West Coast. West Coast editions. Whatever it was, they were very rare for their time. And DC was experimenting, apparently, considering changing the name of the entire line to Superman Comics. Now, this idea was reportedly quickly aborted, but they tested these Superman logos, not just on Justice League number 3, but also on the cover with a separate piece of art on Firestorm number 61. They got entirely new cover art along with this bullet in the corner that says Superman Comics instead of DC Comics. So they were test marketing. Somebody in the marketing department was figuring, "Hey, what if we did this? Would this juice our line of comics?" DC had, even through all of their success through 85 and 86, they were still coming in far short to Marvel Comics, who was the market leader. So you have to imagine behind the scenes, DC is continuing to stir things up and looking to try to find ways with which to get their books to stand out more in the marketplace. And I'm not sure that that Firestorm 61 and Justice League number 3 were not deliberate, just kind of gauge the market, put a hot book out there to just get people talking and get people excited. I asked Rick if he could put one on hold for me and I could buy it for $10, because he was marking them up to $10, and I would have one in my own collection. And I'm telling you, I'd pull it out regularly and just stare at it, because it was like, what does this even mean? Is this the future? Are there going to be, you know, are there going to be alternate versions of these comic books, and a variant comic book that really had no announcement, but it was something that DC was offering to select retailers? Again, from my own retailer telling me they were regional, to, "Hey, these are just Southern California variants." No matter, it had the impact and it got the market a buzz. And at the time, you know, when the 90s rolled around, The Wizard at its peak was marking the Justice League and the Firestorms in the $90 and $60 range. Now, I think today they've calmed down substantially. But so we've got the Man of Steel variant that happened a year earlier, and now DC is test marketing regional variants with a completely different title for their company, Superman Comics, as opposed to DC Comics. I mean, again, if you're a collector and you go to that, I can't not have it. These Justice League and Firestorm variant covers were in much shorter supply, and as a result, especially at the conventions that summer, in much higher demand. The full explanation was that DC Comics was looking to pivot to the Superman comic books test logo. And again, the actual the dialogue that is being exchanged between Captain Marvel and Batman is a little more like a throwback to a decade earlier. Hang on, Batman, I'm coming. Don't save me, Captain Marvel. Save the world from nuclear destruction. It's a little more campy. And the idea was with Superman comics, Trade Dresch, and the different approach on the cover, they were going to, they were testing to see if they could reach younger readers. And with these covers that that they said were primarily going to be distributed on the newsstand, but were made available again in very small allotments to the direct market, the newsstand was in total decline at the time. It was down 30% from previous years and 30% overall, given the track record of newsstand at the time. So DC will tell you that that's what they were engaging in when they were pursuing these very special variants. But having been the guy that unboxed them and being, you know, a huge Kevin Maguire fan, seeing that on top of the 30 regular issues, there were these two variants, I was like, wait, what? I had to have this. I mean, literally, Trade Dresch be damned. I bought it because it was another version of Kevin Maguire's art, okay? Because in that way, I'm feeling you. You're feeling me. It's kind of what we do. It's kind of what we're into. Now, DC has indulged in this twice, 1986 and 1987. Do you really think that Marvel is not going to take their shot here? Because they are about to, as the variant cover experimentation continues. Because come on, they're not going to just watch the competition get the buzz and get these extra sales. And they are going to 100% indulge in this, which they did with the very memorable, especially at the time. Again, this is right as I am about to exit retail because I'm getting jobs in the comic book world, in the wedding of Peter Parker and Mary Jane, the giant sized annual Amazing Spider-Man wedding issue, the giant sized annual, number 21, released in 1987. There was two split covers, one with Peter Parker getting married to Mary Jane, and then their friends and family, you know, Aunt May and J. Jonah Jameson, you know, the other assorted family members. Everyone's in tuxedos and wedding garb, standing behind very handsome Peter Parker and Mary Jane in her gown. The other variant cover is Spider-Man standing with Mary Jane, and in the background is Doc Ock, Kingpin, Electro, about to face off against Daredevil, Wolverine, Captain America, and the Human Torch. So much like the Man of Steel variant, they stated that there was going to be a newsstand direct market variant version, and that's how they justified producing these at the time. It was like they were scared to say, hey, we're just going to give you two. They were like, well, one is a newsstand and one is direct market. But both covers are incredibly striking. As a fan, I wanted the Spider-Man with the Electro, Doc Ock, you know, Kingpin, of course, and Lizard, Electro, Doc Ock, Kingpin, and Lizard on one side, and Wolverine, Captain America, Daredevil, and Human Torch on the other side, and of course, Spider-Man in his full Spider-Man costume. Now, the reports of this go on to say that there isn't really a big differential, even to this day, in the prices on these. But nonetheless, if you don't think that this goosed numbers, it absolutely 1,000% goosed numbers. I remember this is right before I was leaving, because I didn't make it much past the middle of the fall of that year. But I always kind of bide my time. Is by the time Dark Knight 4 and we were closing in on Watchmen number 12 came, that was my end of my retail era. And then I was doing comic books and starting my career full time. Having gotten hired in 86 to start doing work, it was going beyond just short stories, covers, and pinups. And I was being called to do much, much more intensive work. And so this part-time comic book retail job had to be retired. And I distinctly remember pulling these Amazing Spider-Man books out and putting them on the shelves as well. And again, we are now living in, for the third time in about a year and a half, a two cover comic book world, select comics are getting two covers. The variant cover is very much happening. So the disparity, truthfully, in the Amazing Spider-Man's were greater because more people, you've just got to be, you know, just honest. You would rather have the books called Spider-Man. You want Spider-Man in costume with his costumed villains and his heroic friends. Mary Jane is exactly the same on both. And while having Peter Parker and his wedding party and friends and family is nice to have, it wasn't seen as the necessity as maybe some of the other, like the giant Superman logo. But again, as the story goes, the pricing around both of them didn't change much. But and given that it was Marvel, that it's not like these covers. This is not an obscure title. Amazing Spider-Man was one of their top books, so it got a tremendous amount of orders. And again, two covers, double your orders. That you know, every retailer I knew had to have both, had to feature both. So we are deeply now entrenched in this idea of special editions getting multiple covers. But it was 1989, still in the 80s, that this completely blew the doors off. We've talked about the coming of the summer of 1989 Batman film, Michael Keaton, you know, Tim Burton directed, Jack Nicholson. This was a big damn deal. And this was the one that completely blew the doors off. Given that there was a giant production of Batman headed to theaters in the summer of 89, DC Comics wanted to make sure they had a new title to run alongside the movie, a new edition that people could walk in and start fresh with, a new number one. So they announced that they were doing Legends of the Dark Knight, number one. And it would be released to coincide with the big budget Batman film that was taking the entire, you know, world by storm. I mean, it was the buzz, the Prince music videos. Spring of 1989 was just crazy hot with all things incoming regarding Batman. So this was going to be the third dedicated title devoted to the Caped Crusader at the time. And the orders came in. This is how the story goes. This is how DC will tell you, is that the numbers came in so large that it frightened the head of DC's marketing. His name was Bruce Bristow. And he believed that if they released these comics into the marketplace as they had planned, with just the covers that they had planned, that it would be too much and retailers would eat them. They then made the decision very late in the release game that there would be four different covers. And I have talked about this early on in Rob Observations in season one. This just cracks me up because I remember at the time, this is when I was like, there's something going on here. I'm in the business. I am working at Marvel. I am drawing X-Men related material. I am starting on the New Mutants. I have done X-Men annual. So I am, again, deeply entrenched in my own career now at Marvel, having done Hawk and Dove and walked across the street. I had done issues of X-Factor, X-Men, New Mutants was incoming. I had done a Spider-Man annual in 1989 and a New Mutants annual in 1989. I was doing my What If Wolverine. So I was very much aware of the marketplace, but like you, I was going to the comic store every Friday. Again, comics released during Fridays. At this point, it was always Friday release dates. My entire childhood, it was the middle of the 90s that Wednesday was chosen as the release day in the same manner that new albums and records back when that was a thing at your local record store were coming out on Tuesdays. It was seen as the midweek release was the most advantageous. But these comics were hitting on Friday afternoons, and I was at the comic store with all the rest of you because I wanted my new comics. I was not that much into Batman, and I certainly wasn't excited about this new team because it just wasn't a team that really spoke to me. But the retailers got notice that the four different covers would be a cardstock overlay of the existing, the number one cover. They all had the same cover underneath the cardstock, but there was a yellow cardstock, a pink cardstock, an orange cardstock, and a teal blue cardstock. Those were your differentials, just literally four separate covers. I think they had to go back to press and they added another color, but the release of these books that hit your stores were yellow, pink, orange, and teal blue. They sold like crazy, like hotcakes. I was there. The retailers were shocked. People were buying all four. Very few people, as I was standing in Comet Castle in Adventureland, those afternoons, people were buying all four. And again, I sat there and I'm like, do I get all four? And I, you know, you see someone say, excuse me. They kneel down. These were on the lower rung of the shelf in Adventureland. And somebody goes, one, two, three, four. Another guy goes, two of each, two, two, two. And then I sprang into action. I can't be left behind. I had to be included in this. And what do you know? I left with a yellow, a pink, an orange, and a teal, just like so many of you did. The four cardstock covers, that's all. There's a silhouette of the Batman. It's just a black silhouette of Batman is on each of these, which underneath is another cover. But this cardstock was only differentiated by color. Trade dress, everything else on this cardstock was the same. It's just, did you want the yellow? Did you want the pink? Did you want the orange? Did you want the teal? And so many of us, we grabbed every single one of them. These were highly sought after and absolutely disappeared. And people, I didn't remember anyone saying, which one's the least? Which one's the rarest? I'm sure that happened in your store, and maybe it happened in mine. I just, during those 10, 20 minutes in each store, it didn't happen to me. It was just, you had, most people wanted to have all of them by the set. They're being displayed as a set by the set. And as you know, this would then open the door because Marvel is like, oh, hell, we can do this and one better. 1 year later, Marvel Comics would give you four versions of Todd McFarlane's Spider-Man number one, and it would break records. It would sell in the millions. Polybagged versions, black and silver version of the art, the full colored version of it, different treatments, different approaches to the coloring and the presentation of the image, and different poly bags. And it ushered in the new mega million selling variant. But it doesn't happen unless Marvel looks with envy and with let's just be honest, with dollar signs at the cardstock variant coup that DC pulled off. Now, it was seen again that, man, this is really part of the Batman movie hype. And trust me, I remember that summer because I was now persona non grata with DC Comics because I did not extend their invitation to stay on Hawk and Dove. After, go listen to my Hawk and Dove, dedicated Hawk and Dove podcast. I was treated the entire time like the worst heap of garbage and had no idea that Hawk and Dove was burning up the charts. Again, until I read retail reports and people told me, you have a hot book. You have a hot book. Well, the way that I was literally treated like a guy who had to hand in pages above the cracks, through the cracks above the dungeon cellar that I was being held in. So I was terribly mistreated. So happy to get a call towards the end of my Hawk and Dove run by the editor of the X-Men, who said, Rob, do you want to come work in the X office? And I've detailed how I thought that was a prank call. That couldn't possibly be. But now I had kind of found my home, my niche with Marvel Comics. But the DC people were walking around like, oh yeah, we own comics. The Batman movie. This hype can't be replicated. And then game, set, match, exceed, bonus points to Marvel for 1 year later without a movie, with just talent and fever and marketing. The Todd McFarlane Spider-Man ushered in the 90s to then follow the very next summer with the 5 million seller. We doubled the Spider-Man numbers with characters basically you'd never heard of before. Cable and Deadpool and Domino and the lot were only about 18 months old. X-Force still holds the number two slot. And then X-Men, obviously, with their multi six variant covers, which launched that book into the stratosphere of 8 million sales. But the birth of the variant cover, as we have covered today, happens in the 80s. It is one of the eight 80s events that shaped the 2000s. Because think of where we are now. Think of the retailer who's having to figure out how many copies of the new fill-in-the-blank launch that he is going to order. What is the demand? How does he not get stuck with X amount of cover that nobody wants? My thing with variant covers is if they're well done and the execution of the cover is at a high level, I will desire it. I buy variant covers, people. I don't just talk about it. It's not just a topic on my podcast. I participate. I buy variant covers. I'll buy a cool cover no matter who draws it, as long as it looks cool. I am a participant. I can't possibly get them all. And I understand that the retail participation variants are key to so much of the success of the books that are being put out today. I participate as well. Not only did I contribute a Thundercats number one variant to the launch of that line, but I bought Thundercats variants for my store. A very specific shot of Lion-O that I wanted that you could only get from me. So in that way, I am participating as a retailer, buying my own variants while also contributing to the mass market variant of the same title. So I get variants. I believe that the variant should have a purpose. It should be unique. It should be a shot that people want. There has been a lot of discussion as to, well, which is more important in regards to art? Hey, the art is the art. If there's a couple different covers on a number one retail or otherwise, that is a legitimate cover to that number one comic. Now, people will focus on the A comic, but there are instances where the art for one of the variants is so iconic and so memorable and so desired that it carries the exact same weight. It carries the exact same desire, sometimes even more so than the quote unquote A cover. So variants, it's a mixed bag, and that debate is going to continue to rage. But today was about taking you back to when Man of Steel gave you the first incentive to buy more copies with a separate piece of John Byrne art that was different from the direct market. And then, of course, the Chase variants, the regional variants that were produced alongside the Justice League and the Firestorm comics in 1987 that immediately caught fire and became the buzz. Marvel Comics, The Amazing Spider-Man, Wedding of Peter Parker and Mary Jane, and the differential variants on that book, which led us to the explosion of the cardstock Dark Knight covers and opened the door for everything that would come in the 90s. Those Dark Knight cardstocks, that success was the head scratcher, not just to me, to everyone who said, whoa, again, what if there was actual four different pieces of artwork on those instead of just cardstock with different colors of the rainbow? Imagine, again, maybe the reaction is even more through the roof. What a great topic. What a fun time. The 80s is way more important, again, than you think, which is why we're doing this series. Eight 80s events that shaped the 2000s, that informed the 2000s. I keep telling you, the playbook is in the 80s. The 90s was just sheer chaos, and in many cases, only following what was established in the 80s. You thought, no, variant covers blew up in the 90s. No, they didn't. They started in the 80s. We covered it here. Today, we gave you dates. We gave you the receipts. Those are meant to, again, inform you of the history of the events and the movements in comics that have shaped our modern-day market. Can I just tell you how much I just have the best fun, the most fun talking comics with all of you. Thank you so much for being a part of the show and participating and just always actively engaging. And I just thank you so much for being just the best audience. Listen, we have been number one, the number one comic book podcast all of 2024 to date. There is not a day in 2024 that we have not been the number one comic book podcast. And that is because of you. And I just want to thank you for that. I have a special announcement that is going to expand the Robservation Nation somewhat, just a little bit. I have been recording episodes that are going to go on my Patreon page that I've had for a couple of years. And what they are is bonus content. They are not necessary. You don't have to listen to them. If you only want to listen to these Tuesday and Friday installments, please carry-on. They're going to be available. There is no shortage. I'm going to take a break here. A spring break is coming imminently. But as far as once that re-engages, there's so much to talk about constantly, and I'm going to continue to post episodes on across all these platforms. But over on my Patreon, I will be giving you bonus content, bonus episodes. And the first of those bonus episodes is a great comic book feud that I've never covered before that is very, very interesting in regards to how all of the events kind of line up to create some of the resentment and some of the brushback. And there was consequences for a publisher in all of this. In this particular comic book feud that is featured in our inaugural, our launch episode, which is going to be part of my Patreon subscription. There's artwork and sketches and images that I've been offering to my Patreon subscribers for years, but now it's going to be joined by special Robservation content. We're calling that the Robservation Nation bonus content. So check it out if you'd like, and I will pass along my Patreon information to you, and of course there'll be links to that on social media so that you can follow it easier. If you go to Patreon and you look up creators, I am Rob Liefeld. My icon is similar to my Twitter icon. It's got me surrounded by the Deadpool heads, but you can then go through and figure out which platform you want to subscribe to. But again, part of our Patreon is going to be offering exclusive content, exclusive Robservation content, so you can catch it. Again, it is completely different, totally different subjects, just as in-depth, same format, but it is bonus content. And again, it does not take away from the Tuesday, Friday episodes, but if that is something you want to participate in, that is now going to be made available to you through my Rob Liefeld Patreon. Again, there'll be links on my Twitter where I'm at Robert Liefeld, full name Robert Liefeld, that with a blue check over on Twitter. On Instagram, I am at Rob Liefeld. Again, blue check, Rob Liefeld, Robert Liefeld, Robert Liefeld on Twitter/X, Rob Liefeld on Instagram. There will be links available on both of those in case you need help finding my Patreon. Again, this is exciting. It's bonus content. It's just another way to interact and get even more of the topics and the comic book talk that we have kind of grown to enjoy. Tuesdays, Fridays are still going to be full with brand new stuff. So again, no need if you don't want to participate on the Patreon, but it's there. It's part of my overall subscription now, and I wanted you to know about it. I've covered where I am on X. I've covered where I am on Instagram. On Facebook, I am in a group. I am in a Facebook group. It's called Rob Liefeld, Marvel Extreme and Beyond. I would love for you to be a part of it. We share all sorts of great comic book talk over there, and it is like an extension of this. It is an extension of really this podcast. We go much deeper and discuss so many of the topics here that we discuss. We do over there in longer form. You can just have more of a conversation. It's a super fun group. I am co-administered, co-moderated with a gentleman named Terry Sala, S-A-L-A. You may see his name. He may be the one that clicks you on through to the membership in the Rob Liefeld Marvel Extreme and Beyond group on Facebook. We hope to see you there. I am all over Whatnot, my live streams. We have so many cool things that we're going to be bringing you. We've got our very special edition X-Men 97 animated series number ones that will be offered as soon as April 11th. There is going to be a number of different versions, a couple of surprise versions that we haven't shared with you just yet, but this is the most desired comic book I have had in my 40 years doing this. I kid you not. You have DM'd me and contacted me and made me offers that I seemingly can't refuse to release them early, and I can't. I won't break the embargo. But if you want to get some of our different variations, it's a really fun piece that I was able to do for X-Men Animated 97, and I want very much to get those into your hands. Those will be only available through my Whatnot live stream, just like my new Last Blood comic issue 2 is about to be released. Issue 1 was just an absolute blowout success. It details much of the fate of my extreme library of characters. I am penciling and inking and writing this series, since I created all these characters, if someone is going to have a final say and how they turn out, I figured it should very much be me. I'm having the time of my life doing this, different variations. And actually the book itself is only in any variation available through me on my live stream. Again, the X-Men 97 variants are on the way. There is so much new product that we're going to be putting out there. I offer art, remarked toys, remarked Funko Pops, remarked comics, special logos. You want to get on the Whatnot app and follow me at Rob Liefeld to be alerted when I go live. I am speaking right into the camera. It is me that you are talking to for 2+, sometimes 3 hours. I have such a good time on the live streams. I have made so many great new relationships and just so many new friendships through the live stream. It's such a fun, you know, just a fun portal to be involved in Whatnot. They have their act together. It is a one really cool, awesome platform. So I invite you to participate with us over there. Wow. We have a lot going on, including a private in-house signing over at CGC. I want you to know about this. The Deadpool Wolverine movie that literally everyone tells me is going to be the biggest movie of all time. I literally, if I had a nickel for every time somebody told me that just without, with just the one trailer that they've seen, and even prior to that, that it was going to be this giant success. It just speaks to the anticipation of getting this third installment. That's coming out July 27th, and we want to get your books to you before that comes out. And we can do that if you meet the May deadline, and I can then get to CGC in June and be in-house for my second private signing. We did thousands upon thousands of books in my first one this last fall. Your New Mutants 87s, your New Mutants 98, your Deadpool Core number one, your Deadpool Merc with the Mouth, first appearance of Lady Deadpool, your Youngblood, your Prophets, your Avengers, your Captain America's, your Snake Eyes, whatever you want me to sign and get graded. I'm telling you, we proved the skeptics wrong with the first signing. The books came back ridiculously fast, and they came back in great conditions in grades that you guys raved about. So please go to the CGC website, pull down the menu, look for the Rob Liefeld in-house signing, and make sure you get your stuff in before the deadline. I will be looking to sign your books. I am so excited to get these books to you and to see what it is you're exactly sending me. Again, thank you so much for listening. Look for the bonus content if that's what you're into on my Rob Liefeld Patreon. Look for Rob Liefeld, the creator, the creator's page on Patreon, and look to interact with me there. We, at the end of each and every episode, share the incredible reviews that you leave for us across all of these crazy platforms, the most popular of which is the Apple platform, and you have been so ridiculously generous in sharing your enthusiasm for the show for years now. Again, it's why we are able to boast the success that we're boasting. It's because of you. It's because of you and your excitement. And I never in a million years thought that we would be able to have this kind of interaction and exchange this level of excitement. But you have been just leaving these incredible reviews for us. I could not be more excited, more enthused to share your reviews that you have left for me over these last few years, and you continue to. And so we read them here at the end of every show. And this is from a listener, Designed for Action. He says, Designed for Action says, "Hey, I just discovered your podcast and I listen to them while I work out. Listening to these reminds me of the conversations I had growing up about comic books. I think we are around the same age. I have a great collection of original art and commissions by all the guys that you like. Anyway, I just enjoy listening to you. I'm a huge John Byrne and George Perez fan." Thank you, Design for Action, for leaving that review for me. I read them out loud. I identify you. I share your reviews at the end of each and every show, whether they're left through a direct message or many of you on the Apple podcast. I am so thrilled to receive these, to know that you are enjoying the show as much as I enjoy doing the show. So thank you. Continue to listen, continue to share those reviews. I'll read them at the end of each and every show. You know that at the very end, which is where we're at, I just want to wish you all the very best. I hope that your spiritual, your mental, emotional, and physical well-being is exactly where you need it to be, that you are at peace, that you are at that you are happy, that you are finding peace, that you are finding happiness. My encouragement to you, as always, I practice what I preach, is get off the grind. Make time for yourself. Hey, maybe it's a better lunch than you're used to. Maybe it's a kick-ass dinner with your wife, your family, your girlfriend, your boyfriend, whatever extra that you put into it, that just eases your mind, gets you away from the grind. And maybe it's on that recliner, in that beanbag, in that sofa chair, catching up on your latest streaming show, watching X-Men 97 on Disney Plus, which is blowing up, reading a great graphic novel, a comic book, maybe just reading a fantasy novel, sci-fi novel. Again, going out with friends, with family, having great food, having great desserts. Oh, I love the great desserts. You anticipate that I'm about to bring up the Reese's Big Cup, and I'm kind of going to. I'm really on the Easter egg kick right now. I am telling you, the chocolate on the specialty, the Valentine's eggs and the Easter eggs, they've always tasted differently, but never have they just satiated me more than now. I am consuming the Easter egg products, and it's almost Easter, so those are going to go into the discount bin, just like I bought all the Valentine's in the discount bin. Yay, chocolate. Yay, candy. Yay, Rob Liefeld and his discount bins. Anyway, those are some of the best seconds of each and every day, that chocolate, that combining that peanut butter with my tongue and the sensation. And I just, oh man, if every second of every day could feel like a Reese's peanut butter cup, right? That's my goal. Look, I may be ridiculous, but I am rooting for you despite my ridiculousness. I wish for you all the best. Fist bump, boom, right through the Blue Yeti mic that I talk to, that I talk into, that I speak with you, that I share this show with you through. Just take care of yourself. Be well. And do not leave me behind. Come back and find me. I'm going to be right here. Catch me, because I'll be here with a new show. And most, the most essential part of this is the promise, the declaration that we will absolutely, most definitely, and inevitably talk again real soon.